Hi, everyone. My name is Will Caringcross, and I'm here in place of Eric Cornell, who's very sorry he couldn't be here. But I'm honored to be here, and thank you to all the previous speakers who did a really excellent job introducing and motivating these EDM searches. So I'm going to tell you about an ongoing EDM search at Jilla, an electron EDM search using molecular ions. So you've all seen a lot of slides like this one before. How we would like to measure an electron EDM. The long story short of it is that we're going to place an electron in a large external electric field and parallel magnetic field and flip its spin using an RF photon and measure some small energy difference away from that energy generated from the magnetic field and observe whatever change we see. And that'll be proportional to an electron EDM. And the precision with which we can do this depends on a number of factors, as you've seen before. The various things we would like, well, for example, we would like to place this electron in a very large electric field to maximize that energy difference. We would like to make a large number of counts in order to split this resonance and measure this difference very precisely. Or we would like to measure this spin precession for a very long time in order to make a narrow resonance and make the most precise measurement we can. So this is a choice that you have to make when you design one of these experiments. And in the case of molecular ions, we've essentially made the choice of attempting to obtain a very long coherence time. So that, in principle, comes in linearly. However, when you get to long enough coherence time, it actually should be under that square root. So our choice, molecular ions, what advantages do they offer? Well, they have very large effective electric fields on the order of gigavolts per centimeter. They have, as John talked about just a moment ago, this omega doublet feature, which essentially is a co-magnetometer. It allows us to switch the large gigavolt per centimeter electric field with only changing an acousto-optic modulator. And finally, for our choice, we can trap these molecular ions in order to probe them and have long coherence times. In our case, our science state lifetime is about 2 seconds, and that's the ultimate limit on the coherence time of our experiment. So our choice is the molecular ion hafnium fluoride, and I'll be telling you about that today. So here's a little overview of my talk. I've given you a brief introduction, so I'll tell you some more details about the guts of our experiment, how we perform this experiment. I'll tell you about our Ramsey spectroscopy, where we measure the EDM. I'll tell you about the efforts we went to in 2015, essentially the entirety of that year was dedicated to studying systematic errors in our system. And I'll tell you about our ongoing, kind of almost complete EDM measurement, which we hope to publish soon. So here's a cartoonish overview of our apparatus. We have a pretty standard physical chemistry tool, which is a pulsed supersonic beam source, which generates neutral hafnium fluoride. These enter our ion trap, which has these six radial electrodes. They enter this region at about 600 meters per second. We use several UV photons to create hafnium fluoride ions with pretty high efficiency, about 30% in their row vibrational and electronic ground state. And we then apply a stopping voltage kick, and we apply trapping electric fields using these electrodes. We then superimpose a rotating electric bias field, which I've written here as EROT, which polarizes these molecules in a rotating frame. We would like EROT to be the largest electric field sort of within this ion trap. We would like it to dominate the electric fields that the ions see. And so in order to prevent these ions flying out of the trap, it has to rotate, and it has to rotate at a rate much faster than the trapping fields. And so that rotates on the order of 250 kilohertz. And so this makes for an interesting environment to perform a precision measurement. Namely, there are all sorts of electric fields going on here, and that's precisely what our molecules are sensitive to. However, it also offers some advantages. Namely, when we perform this experiment in a rotating frame, nominally makes us not sensitive to DC magnetic fields, or electric fields for that matter. So here's sort of a timing diagram of our experimental sequence. We ablate hafnium, we ionize into hafnium fluoride, and trap these ions in our ion trap. We then turn on our rotating electric field, and using some lasers applied along the axis of our ion trap, we transfer population to our science state, and then we proceed with our Ramsey sequence, and in the end, we read out molecules by dissociation, which I'll tell you about in a moment. So as John mentioned, the structure of these molecules is somewhat complex, mostly just in that they have many levels. However, as John mentioned, there's a significant separation of energy scales, which simplifies things. So in hafnium fluoride, we create ions in their ground singlet sigma electronic state. And using two lasers in a stimulated Raman process, we transfer this population to the first excited electronic state, triple delta 1, where we perform our EDM measurement. Specifically, we transfer it to the ground vibrational, ground rotational, and ground hyperfine level in that electronic state. So the structure of triple delta 1, J equals 1, F equals 3 halves, looks a bit like this. In no electric or magnetic fields, we have magnetic sublevels ranging from minus 3 halves to plus 3 halves. There's a residual splitting due to omega doubling. In the presence of an electric field, we get a Stark shift, which separates these two doublets. If we add a magnetic field, we gain Zeeman shifts between the magnetic sublevels. And then finally, the effect of an EDM, were there to be one, would be to apply an additional residual shift between this upper Stark doublet and lower Stark doublet, which has opposite sign depending on the internal electric field of the molecule. And a final effect, and one which sort of complicates our lives a bit, is that of rotation. So we perform this experiment in a rotating frame. And so there's some added contribution to the effective Hamiltonian of our molecule due to this rotation. And what that actually does is it couples states of adjacent MF, and it also couples states of opposite omega. And so I've drawn one example path by which we could perturbatively couple our two science states, which we want to observe the EDM shift between. And what this gives rise to, if you consider an effective Hamiltonian for just the two states in this upper Stark doublet or just the states in the lower Stark doublet, this gives rise to an off-diagonal coupling term, which depends on the rotation rate as well as the magnitude of the rotating electric field. So some advantages. Well, one advantage for this is that it actually allows us to perform our pi over 2 pulses. This is how we perform our state preparation. However, there's some disadvantages, namely, this is essentially just complicating our lives, making us perform this spin precession experiment in the presence of this term. So our Ramsey sequence looks a little bit like this. When we perform our population transfer, we produce an incoherent mixture of these opposite magnetic sublevels. We then apply some circularly polarized light from the side of our ion trap, which depletes the population in one of the magnetic sublevels. We apply a pi over 2 pulse by reducing the magnitude of the rotating electric field for about a millisecond, which allows the population to evolve into a superposition of these two states. And then we have a variable Ramsey time, a variable evolution time, in which these states acquire relative phase. A second pi over 2 pulse projects that population, projects that phase onto a relative population between opposite magnetic sublevels. And then we alternately either read out one magnetic sublevel or the other, depending on a choice of our second round of polarized depletion. And then our final signal, what it looks like in the end, is we dissociate all of the remaining population in this triple delta 1 J equals 1 level into hafnium ions mixed with some residual hafnium fluoride in the trap. We kick all of these ions out onto an ion detector and detect hafnium in time of flight. We can generate an asymmetry from that hafnium number as a function of Ramsey time, as a function of free evolution time. And we generate Ramsey fringes, which look something like this. So you can see that free evolution time, this is where our precision comes from, is the long free evolution time, which in this case is 500 milliseconds, but we've demonstrated up to a second. And you can see that we have collected this population difference at early time and at late time, which is actually sort of an advantage. It allows us to be robust to a number of systematic errors associated with state preparation because we don't have to make any assumptions about this initial phase. We can simply measure it. One question that we asked, and which you might ask, is what is limiting this coherence time? We would really love to take Ramsey fringes with the full triple delta 1 state lifetime of about 2 seconds. So we spent some time in 2014 studying what limits our coherence. The ultimate limit is the triple delta 1 state lifetime of 2 seconds. However, other limits are ion-ion interactions in our ion trap and inhomogeneity of our electric and magnetic fields. For collisions, when we trap a cloud of thermal ions in the trap, these ions are about 10 Kelvin. When they undergo a collision, their monopole electric field from each other sort of adds to the rotating electric field in the ion trap and essentially allows them to accumulate little geometric phases as they encounter each other and move apart. So that limits our coherence time depending on the ion number. Here's the dependence of the coherence time on the rotating electric field. Currently, this is simply a technical limit here. However, if you increase the size of that rotating electric field, you can dominate over collisions in the ion trap. So that's essentially all that goes into an EDM measurement. These are the things that sort of make up the basis of our experiment. On the surface of it, it's as simple as that. We perform a spin precession measurement in the upper doublet or the lower doublet. And in principle, if we subtracted those two frequency measurements, we should get an EDM measurement. However, obviously, there's a lot more to this because a lot more factors come into these measured frequency differences. We need some method of isolating the EDM signal from signals of different parity with respect to, for example, applied magnetic fields. So how we do this is something which John described in quite a bit of detail. ACME calls them parity sums. I think that's an excellent name. And for whatever reason, we call them frequency channels. It's the same thing. So essentially, what we do is we have three binary switches in our experiment. We have the sign of our rotating magnetic field, the sign of the effective electric field, namely the upper or lower Stark doublet where we perform our experiment. And we also have a third switch, which is quite different from another EDM experiment, which is the sense of the rotation of a rotating electric field. And this ends up being actually quite important for us. So we collect 2 to the number of switches, so 8 Ramsey fringes, and then we combine these measured frequencies with the given signs that I've shown here into 8 frequency channels. So at this point in time, a lot of what we think about on the experiment is modeling these frequency channels. One of these channels contains the EDM signal. However, the others can, as John mentioned, contain a lot of other information about what's going into our measured frequencies and sources of systematic error. So we spend a lot of time performing some analytic calculations on an effective Hamiltonian for this triple delta 1 J equals 1 manifold. And we also spend a lot of time on numerical modeling of these frequency channels. And just to give you a general idea of the sort of leading order terms of a few of these, the completely symmetric combination of these frequencies just gives us our average Ramsey fringe frequency. That's not too exciting. What we call the FB channel tells us something about the non-reversing magnetic field if our magnetic field chop from one direction to the other is not perfect. Tells us something about the magnitude of the non-reversing field. The FD frequency channel tells us about the difference in magnetic G factor between the two Stark doublets. We have a frequency channel telling us about geometric phases acquired when the rotating field rotates in one direction or the other. And then finally, the nominally EDM-dominated channel, which could also contain some contamination from systematics. For example, a combination of this non-reversing magnetic field with the magnetic g-factor difference between doublets could contribute in that channel. So having gotten all of these steps working, then kind of around the beginning of 2015, we said, OK, what sort of systematics will we observe in this experiment? Nobody's ever done an experiment with this sort of strange rotating geometry before. What are we going to see? So we did, as John mentioned, we followed the tried and true method of turn some knobs and see what happens. So just as a few examples, one key one is the position of the ion cloud in the trap, which we can change by applying DC voltages to the electrodes. External magnetic fields are always a concern. Our experiment actually has no magnetic shielding, which is really unique for EDM experiments. And that's because of our steadfast belief that we should not be sensitive to DC fields. We could change our rotating field magnitude or frequency. We could change the number of ions or their density, state preparation, et cetera. So we started doing this. And you're not meant to look too closely at these figures, but we started seeing all kinds of frequency shifts. We changed parameters. Things were moving all over the place. I just pulled these out of my lab notebook. But things were a little confusing for a time. And so what it really came down to was this step became pretty critically important. So we have developed some pretty extensive numerical models of our experiment. We model this 12-state sublevel. We also sometimes include the J equals 2 level, which takes it to 32 states. And we simulate the motion of ions classically in some numerically simulated time-dependent electric and magnetic fields in our ion trap. And as a result of this modeling, we've really been able to tease out, we believe, every significant effect that we've observed at this point. So I'll walk you through a few of these, since these have dominated our attention for the past, well, not this past year, but the year before. So the simplest, the one we all, the one we know very well about, is some non-reversing magnetic field. This, in principle, shows up in our FB channel, which tells us just about the non-reversing magnetic field. However, as I mentioned before, it will have a contribution in the EDM channel. And so we applied some some large non-reversing magnetic fields, and we observed a frequency shift in both the FB channel and the FBD channel. So this, in fact, led to sort of another area where we improved our understanding of these molecules, which is that this FD channel, the difference in magnetic G factor between the two Stark doublets, tells us actually about how the non-reversing magnetic field channel can bleed into the EDM channel. And this, is, in fact, leads to a unique feature of our experiment, which is that this effective g-factor difference between the two doublets actually depends on the rotation rate of our electric field. And there does happen to be a location where we can tune where, in fact, this should go to zero, and we should have no contribution from non-magnetic fields, non-reversing magnetic fields in our EDM channel. So that's sort of a unique feature. I'll maybe skip over this one, and I'll tell you about sort of our equivalent of what the ACME collaboration spent 6 months understanding a very sort of pernicious systematic. We had a really similar experience in 2015. This one we first observed around March 2015. So what we observed was a large frequency shift on the order of several hertz, which can be compared to our sort of our carrier frequency. Our average Ramsey fringe frequency is about 20 hertz. So fractionally, this is an enormous shift. So we observed these frequency shifts. And what it depended on was the radial position of the ions in the trap, the average ion cloud position. And it also was linear in applied magnetic fields, DC uniform magnetic fields, just the kind I told you we weren't sensitive to, and just the kind that we don't have magnetic shielding to stop. So this was extremely disturbing. So we first observed this around March. And on Christmas Day 2015, I woke up and I knew the answer of what it was, which is sort of a funny coincidence. And I'll tell you what it was. So this is a lot. It seems like one of my figures has disappeared, but that's OK. So what was causing this frequency shift? I might add that this several hertz frequency shifts in the so-called FB channel, this is not the EDM channel. However, I just showed you that this non-reversing magnetic field channel does, in fact, sort of leak into the EDM channel in some higher order term. So that's really a big concern for us. This is not what you might call far from the EDM channel. So it turns out that, well, we apply our rotating electric field using high voltage amplifiers, power amplifiers, which is in contrast to many ion trapping experiments, which use resonance circuits to apply their trapping voltages. We use power amplifiers because we apply fairly complicated waveforms, and so this is just a technical reason. However, every power amplifier has harmonic distortion. And so it so happens that the amplifiers we use to generate our rotating electric fields had some second harmonic, which also appeared on the trap electrodes, and of course the ions would see. This harmonic at twice the rotating field frequency would couple adjacent magnetic sublevels, and then the coupling back was provided by transverse magnetic fields with opposite sign for opposite magnetic sublevels. And so this generates a frequency shift, an energy shift between these two levels, which we observed as that linear dependence on ion position, because you're getting closer to the electrodes, which are generating this second harmonic, and dependent on magnetic fields. So fortunately, we were able to suppress this effect by adding in a second harmonic of the rotating field feeding forward at that twice the rotating field frequency. And we were happily able to suppress this effect to far below our EDM, far below where it should appear in our EDM channel. I don't know what happened to that slide. But so with this feeding forward, what we now see is a very small frequency shift, which this is still with one Gauss magnetic field applied through the ion trap. When we zero this magnetic field to a few milligauss, which we're able to do, this effect is essentially completely null. So after all those systematics, we believe we've understood and modeled each of these frequency shifts that we've seen. What have we been working on? Well, we've been collecting EDM data. We've been working on understanding the statistical sensitivity of our system and what limits it. And so here's our measurement in progress. This is just a time series just by index of all of the EDM data we've collected. You can see that it's distinctly non-zero when you look at the FBD channel. That's a blind. So that's a maybe that's a blind. At least some part of that is a blind. So that might be a blind. We do apply a blind. So our strategy with that was to apply a blind which has a value of 40 plus or minus 5 times 10 to the minus 28 e centimeters. So we can see that it's being applied, but there's an unknown part. It's drawn from a random distribution with an uncertainty of 5 times 10 to the minus 28 e centimeters. So it's like saying add an offset plus another unknown offset, essentially. So we've taken 165 hours of blinded data at this point. Our cuts consist only of that data which has very short coherence time, such that in our late time fringe, there's essentially no contrast. And we haven't made any cuts based on the EDM channel itself. What you can see in the bottom left here is sort of a normal probability plot. So what we've done is to scale each of these points to their error bars. The error bar is simply a fit error bar from our nonlinear least squares fitting. And essentially, for Gaussian distributed data, this should all lie on the line. You can see there's some deviation off in the tails. So that's where we're at right now. I hope that you'll see this soon on the archive. But we're still doing some analysis and a few more systematic investigations. So where we're going next? Well, following our current result, I might just mention the one sigma on our current result is this is about 4 times ACME's existing limit from 2014. So this will not set a new limit on the EDM. However, it will basically be an EDM, an Electron EDM experiment performed in a wildly different system, essentially. So where to go next? Well, improving our statistical sensitivity. So we have some fairly short-term improvements. We're building a new ion trap, which should allow us to trap more ions at lower density. We hope to achieve the full coherence time that we should of 2 seconds. We're going to do a few technical things to improve our shot noise. And we would like to do, as John mentioned, stimulated Raman adiabatic passage population transfer. Currently, our population transfer efficiency is about 40%, but nominally with STIRAP, you can achieve more than 90%. And in further in the future, we are also looking to thorium. So currently, we use hafnium fluoride. In thorium fluoride, we recently wrapped up a spectroscopy experiment where we showed that the ground state of the thorium fluoride ion is this triple delta 1 state, which has the co-magnetometer effect, as well as the ground state, it can live for many seconds before it is, in principle, excited by black body radiation. So that also has a much larger effective electric field, not on the order of thorium oxide, but of 35 gigavolts per centimeter compared to about 23 in hafnium fluoride. Our second generation ion trap we plan to put in within the next few months. This is not there's no major conceptual change. Essentially, what we're going for is a significantly more uniform rotating electric field within the same trapping volume. So our current trap is actually about this same size. However, this electrode shape is significantly more optimized to provide a very large region on the order of, say, 2 centimeters by 3 centimeters of uniform electric field with a variation of less than 0.1%. So this will allow us to trap more ions in that region, subject them to exactly the same rotating electric field, which should allow us to decrease our density and achieve more precision in that way. We're also going to put this new ion trap, which will be made of titanium, in a 316 stainless steel chamber, which will basically reduce the presence of magnetic materials, reduce our susceptibility to systematics. So this talk's been a bit short. I guess it was pretty short in preparing it, but I would really like to thank my lab mates, Dan Gresh and Tanya Rusi, who work on the ion trap, Yan Zhou and Kiabun Ng, who work on the thorium fluoride spectroscopy, and of course, my PIs, Jun Yi and Eric Quinnell. And thank you. Yes, John. Oh, sorry. Or. Victor?
Oh. So there is one more, I don't know, advantage of hafnium fluoride, or hafnium, yeah, hafnium fluoride plus, because hafnium has non-zero nuclear spin. So you have additional contribution, which is epsilon and thorium oxide. It's contribution of nuclear magnetic quadrupole moment. So in addition to electron sector, you can also measure CP violation in nuclear sector.
That is, in principle, true. In the current experiment, we use hafnium 180, the isotope without nuclear spin, which has the highest relative abundance of about 30%. However, an odd nuclear isotope, hafnium 177, has relative abundance of about 17%. And yeah, in principle, we could do an experiment on that. I think it would greatly increased angular momentum multiplicity would prove a challenge for our state preparation However, it is in principle possible.
But it's a certain advantage because nuclear magnetic quadrupole moment contribution is bigger than contribution of Schiff moment, naturally.
Right.
And then there is, it's a deformed nuclear, so you have another order of magnitude collective enhancement.
So yeah, so that is something that we have sort of started looking into a little bit, but it's probably quite far down the line.
Yeah, yeah, I understand. It's a challenge to add another angular momentum into problem.
Yeah.
And another question, you see, if you will get bored of getting zero result, you can measure parity violation because there are very close levels of opposite parity, which also enhance EDM contribution, but they also enhance tensor weak interaction. Tensor weak interaction, which appears in deformed nuclear game.
Okay.
So, sorry. <That's> you still need non-zero.
News to me, but okay.
Non-zero nuclear spin. But it's effect certainly exists, so you should get non-zero result, and you may, for the first time, measure quadrupole moment of neutron distribution. You know, there is a lot of interest in neutron skin. You know, it's not in this conference, but in another. So there was a whole conference devoted to study of neutron skin.
Okay.
And it's the motivation was that you know nuclear forces better, you know neutron stars better. But here, it's for the first time possibility to measure neutron quadrupole moment. Again, I understand it's a slightly different experiment, but because you already have molecules.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's, as a grad student, probably the choice that's beyond my pay grade, but but certainly something we should consider. John?
So I think you said this, but with the new trap, the idea is to keep the density the same?
Well, nominally lower density. So
okay.
the coherence time due to collisions scales like a very strong power of the temperature, so about the sixth power of the temperature. However, in ion traps, there's also an issue of RF heating, which is basically always present. And due to just whatever the baseline noise level is on the trap electrodes in the vicinity of the trap secular frequency. So that's always going to be present. However, if we adiabatically expand the cloud, we can achieve lower temperatures until RF heating takes over, but nominally lower density as well. So it'll be some trade-off between higher number and lower density.
Is there any systematics that you've either seen or envision that change as the volume goes up?
Volume, we don't suspect anything. I guess when you say, for example, you consider systematics due to ion-ion interactions, you could imagine. But do you specifically mean
like
the
field,
volume?
Like, you know, field gradients or something? I know you have faith that the magnetic field doesn't matter, but.
Right, right. I think so. Decoherence due to field inhomogeneity would certainly become more of an issue. But in terms of systematics, yeah, I can conceive of one. So, for example, in our ion trap, if there was a linear dependence of the rotating field along the z-axis, because the ions kind of slosh up in the trap and then slosh down in the trap. They slosh and experience a larger rotating field and then down and experience a smaller rotating field. We could see this as a geometric phase effect, but in fact would not be. And then if we tried to shim that out, that could lead to a systematic, I think. So yeah, that's definitely something to consider related to field homogeneity. Yeah.
And just a comment so I don't forget that the 316 should be 316 ln.
That's right.
Okay.
It is that.
Yeah, just a quick question on the magnetic field susceptibility. Have you guys just tried applying a magnetic field to your trap and just varied the field strength and seen that it doesn't contribute to a potential EDM channel?
Oh, yeah.
Maybe
and
I missed that. Sorry.
And in fact, the systematic which I described was discovered doing exactly that. So we applied large magnetic fields in one direction and another. We observed a frequency shift, which we didn't understand. We were then able to model it and eliminate it. And then we eliminated that shift even when a magnetic field was present. And then we zero the magnetic field, which suppresses the effect even further.
Yeah, and one quick question. Did you get, if you reverse the field there with the purple trace, do you get the opposite?
Yeah, slope? So its okay. small slope would then be
it flips.
Flipped, okay. yeah.
Okay, any other questions? Let's thank William and all the speakers today.